This is Dominic Preziosi, editor of Commonweal. For decades, researchers and government officials have measured poverty by focusing almost exclusively on a family's income. That has meant that too often, discussions of poverty and inequality tend to focus on urban America. But Catherine Eden, Luke Schaefer, and Timothy Nelson, three of the country's leading experts on the study of poverty, developed a new way of measuring it. They call it the Index of Deep Disadvantage. This led them to spend time in communities in Appalachia, South Texas, and the Southern Cotton Belt, places whose residents are held back by centuries-long legacies of resource extraction and internal colonization. On this episode, Eden, Schaefer, and Nelson join associate editor Regina Munch to discuss their findings, presented in their recent book, The Injustice of Place, and to offer policy suggestions for building fairer, more egalitarian communities. That's coming right up on the Commonweal Podcast. Hi, Regina. It's good to have you here on the Commonweal Podcast today.
Hi, Dominic. Good to be here.
So I want to learn from you, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about why you wanted to talk to Catherine Eden, Luke Schaefer, and Timothy Nelson about their book.
Sure. I was really excited to talk to them because of their approach to studying poverty. So they compiled with data the Index of Deep Disadvantage, but they also visited the places and wrote about the places that they study and talk with the people who live there to understand what the disadvantage they're talking about really looks like. And the places that they identify and study are mostly rural areas in the South, but they have a lot of features in common, like the history of exploitation and resource extraction. But the book is just really fascinating, and it upends a lot of assumptions that I had about rural areas.
Hey, good. Why don't we take a listen to the conversation?
Thanks, Dominic.
I'm here with the authors of The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. Would you please introduce yourselves?
I'm Catherine Eden. I'm from Princeton University.
I'm Luke Schaefer. I'm a professor of public policy and director of poverty solutions at the University of Michigan.
Timothy Nelson, sociologist at Princeton University.
Thank you very much for talking with me today. Much of your prior research focused on urban poverty. So how did you come to write about the regions, the rural regions that you study in the book?
Yeah, that's true. So the first thing we had to do is figure out how to measure place-based disadvantage rather than people-based disadvantage. And we wanted to move beyond just the government poverty measures and include metrics like health and mobility. So we built an index. We scored every county and city in the U.S. and we put it all on a map. And what we discovered was that all of the regions, with the exception of Native nations, all of the regions of deepest poverty were in the rural South. They were mostly in rural communities of color. So this was a huge challenge to us, but an exciting opportunity to bring attention to places that the American poverty research infrastructure seldom discusses.
Could you say more about the Index of Deep Disadvantage? What did you study exactly?
Of course, when President Johnson started the war on poverty, we didn't even have a way to measure it. Nobody really knew what poverty meant, but beside having known it when they saw it. And so they constructed a measure that was based on people's income. And at the time, food accounted for about a third of the family budget. And so they multiplied that by three to get the poverty threshold. And that's the basic structure of how we've been measuring poverty ever since. There are endless debates about it. But in almost all cases, it's about how much income do you have and how does that compare to a threshold? But we thought when Americans think about poverty, they're thinking about a whole lot of things. It's not just income. Social mobility is a big one, right? If you grow up poor, are you likely to be able to rise to the middle class in adulthood or are you likely to stay poor? And health. I think one of the most visible signs of disadvantage is how we see it through our bodies and through our health. And so we decided to take these three dimensions, income, health, and social mobility, three dimensions of high salience to Americans, and use the incredible dramatic improvements in the data infrastructure to measure these for all counties in the United States in the 500 largest cities. And based on these three factors of income, health, and social mobility, ranked every one of our roughly 3,100 counties and 500 cities on this continuum of disadvantage. That really became the starting point for us. And we could see this map and we could see among that 100 most disadvantaged by these three factors, how they were really clustered in Appalachia, the Cotton Belt throughout the Deep South, and then South Texas. But the thing I love most about this project is not only did we embed our team, our research teams in different communities in these regions, but Kathy and Tim actually drove to something like 75% of the poorest places in the nation. And then they actually went to some of the most advantaged places, which also told us a lot.
We did drive to the county seat of, as Luke said, about 75% of these, of the top 200 most disadvantaged. And what was really striking was not just the usual things you'd expect to see, hollowed out main streets and business districts and abandoned houses and vacant lots and so on. But one thing that I think struck us the most is that these places are not uniformly poor. In fact, the inequality in these most disadvantaged places is higher than the national average. So there was always a boutique store, a refurbished antebellum mansion. There was clearly some wealth left in these places. Not a lot, but it was not just a uniformly devastated landscape.
Yeah, so what we learned is that these are some of the places of greatest inequality in the nation. You know, we usually think of New York and Chicago, but the inequality in these places rivaled the rates in some of our most unequal cities.
What made these communities so disadvantaged? What did they have in common that brought them to where they are?
We didn't initially think that they would have a lot in common necessarily, but it turned out that they did. Both a depth of extraction, these extractive economies that developed around a sole commodity, and exploitation of large swaths of cheap, controllable labor were the prerequisite of the industries that grew up in these places, coal, cotton, tobacco, and lesser known, the vast fields of irrigated vegetables of South Texas that were producing the majority of our onions and spinach and other kitchen staples. Each of these places had these things in common. Mostly, they lacked a middle class. And so as we were observing the extreme labor controls and the suppression of the right to vote among the laboring class, we couldn't help noticing the similarity with colonies outside of the United States. And we really came to the inescapable conclusion that these were colonies, but within our own borders.
I just want to remind people of the actual places that we identified. The clusters of counties are in South Texas, the Winter Garden area, that's just southwest of San Antonio. Central Appalachia, which includes eastern Kentucky and parts of West Virginia. The Tobacco Belt, which is in North and South Carolina. And then the Cotton Belt, which really runs from the Mississippi Delta all the way into the Carolinas. So those were the primary regions that we focused on. And we did develop this idea of internal colonies as a way to understand the deep centuries of exploitation, as Kathy just said.
You talk about the different things that these places have in common, like racially segregated schools, corruption, violence. Could you talk a little bit more about those ways that manifests?
In each of these places, these highly extractive and exploitative economies built structures that continue to live on today, even though the original economic arrangements may have changed. So, of course, you didn't want smart minds, you wanted strong backs in the internal colony. So many of the school systems only lasted 5 months. The kids needed to get out there and help pick the crops. And underprepared teachers, no 12th grade. Really, it was simply appalling, the condition of these schools, including schools in Central Appalachia for the laboring class. And then a tradition of violence really stemming from the labor controls of the haves imposed on the have-nots, which really defy belief. And this is a fairly recent period in our history. And so that violence and the suppression of economic mobility that it was meant to accomplish ends up in the current day sparking violence. When people don't have hope for mobility, this sparks violence. And it locks communities into a structural cycle of violence. Similarly, much of the social infrastructure, maybe the best example of this is in coal country, was owned and operated by the man, so to speak. So even the churches were owned by the coal companies, and the other large employers were really controlling the movie theater, the bowling alley, everything you can imagine, the golf course. And so when those interests pulled out, there was this crumbling of social infrastructure because it had never really developed organically. It had already always been provided to quell any unrest and keep business going. Corruption in these places goes back hundreds of years. In South Texas, corruption was aided and abetted by the Texas Rangers, who would do anything to help the Anglo landowning class suppress the rights of the laboring class. And this goes on today. We see that these are still some of the most corrupt places in America. In a recreation of a pattern, really.
I just wanted to highlight, reflecting on all the things that Kathy mentioned, that this was really a book of surprises for us. Most of the chapters are about things that we really weren't expecting to write about when we went in, and were really a result of deeply getting to know the communities and then looking at the histories. So Kathy mentioned social infrastructure. So these are like the places that people gather to form community ties, and it could be a church, but it could also be the bowling alley or an arcade. It turns out arcades are like really great places to form social infrastructure, social connections. And that really came out of qualitative work as we talked, especially to families in Kentucky, just saying time and time again, the reason kids get into drugs is because there's nothing else to do, nothing to do but drugs. And frankly, the first couple of times we heard it, we didn't take it very seriously. But when you hear it over and over again, this sort of mixed method research makes you listen to that and start to wonder. So we started to look at a lot of research that really, really supports the notion that it's those places where people form ties, as they start to erode, it can lead community residents, especially young people, to go down paths that we wish they hadn't.
Could you say more about how you studied communities? Like in some of the communities that you talk about, you it seems like you got to know like the local lore and the how did you find that? And were people excited to talk about that?
I grew up in rural America, and it's hard to get rural folks to trust outsiders. So when we embedded in each community, we sent a team of researchers who had ties in that community or in a similar community to that place. So somebody who had grown up in Appalachia was on our Appalachian team. And then the way into these communities is really to prove your worth. And so the first thing we would do is start volunteering. So in Central Appalachia, we volunteered at God's Closet, which is a multi-service agency run by a local church. And we volunteered with the NAACP in Marion County. And in every county, we sought opportunities to give back to the community and began to just start showing up in ways that were meaningful. We really tried to hear from locals what was important to them about their story. The spinach festival, Popeye's statue in the middle of the town, the history of these cheerleaders who revolted against, Hispanic cheerleaders who revolted against the racist systems in their segregated schools. So it was just a real joy to learn from people about their community. Some of the things we learned were not so positive, as you can imagine, especially when it came to the local elite. And sometimes there were warring sympathies. So one side would tell us one story and another side would tell us another. One other thing we did is we subscribed to the local paper. And if you ever want to learn about a place, a rural place, this is a great thing to do because you can really keep your hand on the pulse of the week-to-week life of the community. We never thought that when we went to Greenwood, Mississippi, the biggest problem they would name would be violence. But indeed, on the south side of town where most Black citizens lived, they were hunkered down in their homes, afraid to come out in this small town of 13,000 people. Whereas the white people in town were largely oblivious to the epidemic of violence that was gripping the South Side.
We'll have more of Regina's conversation with Catherine Eden, Luke Schaefer, and Timothy Nelson in a minute.
I'm Ellen Koenig, Executive Director of Commonweal. With our centennial just around the corner in 2024, now is a great time to consider making a one-time donation or joining our Associates Program. Thank you very much for your support. It helps make everything we do at Commonweal, our publications, our programming, and this podcast possible.
Based on your research, what steps do you recommend to take to transform disadvantaged places into places where communities can thrive? What I think in the book, you say something like, how do you plan for advantage in a place? How do you structure it to have advantage?
Well, Kathy and I wrote a book a couple years ago, $2 a day. And the nice thing about that book was that the policy sort of solutions were pretty clear. Promote work and also bring back a more dignified version of the cash safety net. And that was a part of the motivation for what we saw in the expanded child tax credit of 2021 that brought child poverty down to an all-time low. Of course, we just had new poverty numbers that came out that showed more than doubling in child poverty as that child tax credit was allowed to expire. So there's this very clear policy choice that the United States is making to say, as a nation, we are okay with more child poverty, but also a very clear solution. In the case of place-based disadvantage, there are many different things that need to be addressed. It has to be a multifaceted approach. And so we don't claim that there's one thing that needs to happen above all else, but it also means that there's lots of different ways to improve. And so we really encourage communities to think about what we offer as a framework for things that they could address and that we think will have a positive impact on communities.
As an example, let's just go to Greenwood, Mississippi, in the heart of the Mississippi Delta for a minute. So they have attracted some industry to the town. Viking Stoves are manufactured there, and Milwaukee Tool offers more than 1,000 jobs to workers in that city. In fact, they're really the only employers in town, or only decent, according to our respondent, employers in town. But they're not, you know, they're paying half the wages they had to pay when they were still in Milwaukee. And of course, there's no Medicaid expansion. So many of the workers are uninsured or not hired full time, so not qualifying for the company's benefits. The Economic Development Foundation there, led by Angela Curry, would like to bring a lot more industry into town. But their white students all go to a segregation academy founded by the founder of the White Citizens Council, Robert Patterson, way back when in the aftermath of Brown v. Board. So are your top executives who may be white going to send their kids to a segregation school? Or are they going to send their kids to a failing public school that has a D or an F grade? All the public investment is gone out of the public schools. Similarly, what do you do about the violence, right? And the corruption. These are places, as I've said, of almost unbelievable corruption schemes, including the welfare scandal in Mississippi that took $80 million out of the mouths of poor, hungry kids and used it to line the pockets of local celebrities and homegrown star athletes, among other uses. So these are correlated problems. And communities, I think, have to really come together to say, what kind of choices can we make now that can overcome the choices we made in the past? How can we improve our schools? How can we make sure that we attract employers that offer people opportunity, because it's opportunity that's going to cure the violence? How can we elect leaders we can trust that aren't going to exploit government contracts and other federal and state dollars coming into places? So it's complicated, but it's not undoable.
I'll give just two very concrete follow-up ideas. So we mentioned local journalism earlier on and how much we've learned by subscribing to local papers. A lot of times, local journalists are the ones that uncover the examples of government corruption, the Mississippi welfare case being the sort of case example. Anna Wolf, a reporter at Mississippi Today, really broke that open. And I think none of us would know about it were it not for her journalism. We see similar stories in other sites. So what more can we do to support local journalism in that like really serious type of work? With education, that's another one where we took a look at a lot of the evidence. And there's this incredible research that shows that desegregating schools has an immense positive impact on Black students and no negative impact on white students. But it looks like the primary driver of that is increased resources in schools that serve students of color. So one of the best evidence-based ways of bringing more resources is to actually pay new teachers more in these districts. So there's huge disparities in what you get paid to work in a more affluent school district versus a less affluent school district. And the work is harder in less affluent school districts where kids just have a lot of challenges. So can we do something to right that ship is, I think, a very practical and clear, not going to solve all of our problems, but the evidence base is strong. And to focus on those new teachers who are coming in, we lose a lot of teachers after 5 or 10 years. So doing more to bring talented people into teaching and keep them there for a little while longer is one of the many solutions. And then Kathy's mentioned that industry brings us to this national topic of free trade. And we see in the communities the vast impact of increasing globalization on the economies, especially after NAFTA and then into the 2000s. And what's clear is that has economic impacts in these communities. These are really some of the biggest losers of that decision. And also politically, so there's a lot of great research that shows globalization leads people to have more extreme, often right-leaning ideologies. And so it does help us understand some of the shifts in the political milieu in recent decades. Social work has always had these like competing identities over time. So there's been over the long term a move towards a social work that's really focused on individual problems. Sometimes that's just therapeutic. Sometimes it's a belief that poverty is the result of individual choices. And so the work should be about caseworkers helping families navigate poverty and do better and escape it. So I think you hear a lot about the helping families escape the intergenerational transmission of poverty. And I think when people think of that, they often think of it as like families that don't know how to escape poverty. They need help. They need mentorship. And most poverty is actually episodic. So that sort of misses most of the action. Most people in poverty work. And so this sort of image is not really reflective of reality. But there's also this long other proud tradition of social work, which is as a lot of our problems started to become concentrated in cities, we could see them. And there were the settlement houses that said, we can do the mentorship and we can help people on an individual basis, but we also need structural solutions to some of this. We need labor law protections. We need to protect children from unsafe working conditions. We need to protect our communities, public health, a lot of the sort of like standards and meatpacking they were a part of. And so actually a ton of our laws and our that part of our social safety net of the 8-hour workday, minimum wages came out of the incredible work of mostly women through at the beginning of the 20th century, pushing for large-scale change. Infant and maternal health clinics all over the country, the first round of that in the 1920s was all driven by structural social workers. I think today, most students of social work are in that individual camp that they really are. Social work has become the fastest way to become a therapist. And so this is a profession that continues to be a battle in conflict with itself about what it's going to be and what the priorities are. And I think this can be a call to say, while the first social workers were all focused on urban areas, the new fields of folks that are actually interested in fixing these problems should also be thinking about rural areas. How do we reach out to them? And every single one of these communities, people, sometimes with social workers, sometimes not, rise up and protest the circumstances. And then there's always a cost to that.
Yeah. Tim, talk about the revolt and retribution chapter a little bit.
Well, so some people might wonder, so if things are so bad in these areas for so long, and also the laboring classes constitute so much of a majority of the population, why do they put up with it? Why don't they revolt? And so as we investigated that, it turns out that the impulse and the activity of rising up and revolting has been tried many times in these communities, both in terms of trying to form labor unions, in terms of political and civil rights activism. So we take in one chapter four sort of case studies, two of which take place during the Great Depression. One is the mine workers' strike in Kentucky in the 1930s, which may, perhaps more people are familiar with. The one that I hadn't heard of was the efforts of organizing sharecroppers through the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, which was started in Arkansas and really was successful in getting better wages for the thousands of sharecroppers and tenant farmers who joined it. Perhaps most importantly, it also brought the plight of the sharecroppers to the nation. And the New York Times focused on this. President Roosevelt was made aware of some of the hardships and so on. Then in terms of politics, we look at South Texas, Crystal City in particular, which was largely Mexican-American, about 85 to 90% of Crystal City, but yet Anglos controlled the entire town government. They controlled the schools and so on. And so we tell the story of just really a really interesting piece of history there, where the Mexican-American population banded together, raised money to cover the poll taxes for the population. This was in the early 1960s, and really won a clean sweep of all the positions in the Crystal City town government. I can't go into all of the ramifications of what happened there, except to say that there was severe backlash on the part of the Anglo population, and including a response, which we see in a number of places, of whites just leaving the community and going elsewhere.
You mentioned the backlash by people in power, by Anglo landowners. And I think in the book, you said that that's still alive in the story of the town and the story that particularly people in power tell about the town. How could that change over time, or how does the truth break through?
You know, it is really interesting how the civil rights activity in South Texas led, right, to widespread enfranchisement of Mexican Americans. I mean, it was really a seminal series of events, but because of Crystal City's role as central in this story, it's been famously called Little Cuba, and funds have been withheld, and all kinds of punishments have been reaped upon the town. And the town has a reputation even today of being a town where workers will rise up if they're not treated fairly, and industry really shuns the town. So sometimes when you're a leader in the struggle, you, even though people around you benefit, you still pay the penalty. And I think there's marks of the retribution in these places. 60, 70 years later, we're still re-legislating these battles and figuring out ways to punish people. But I did want to talk about the significant change that in all cases, these acts of revolt had. So what we see is a story of sort of initial disappointment, a lot of suffering, but then a historic overturning of school segregation, of wresting control from Anglos and distributed it more equitably. You do see this story of incremental progress. And I think that's what we hope for some of these big, exciting policy changes that we've been experimenting with very lately that have had such amazing results, the expanded child tax credit being the main one. We actually did that, even if it was for only a time. This is a legislation that nobody thought would go anywhere. And we did it. And we were able to show that parents weren't spending more money on drugs and alcohol, and that kids were half as likely to be poor, and all kinds of gains to families came from these increased government dollars. And they went to everyone, not just to poor folk. They went to virtually every household, except the households of the very rich. And so they really sent this great social message to parents that society values what you're doing. We know that parenting is hard, raising kids is expensive, and we as a government are endorsing your efforts as parents. So we remain really hopeful about that policy in particular. Also, we take inspiration from these stories of revolt and retribution that in the end, progress can be made even in the face of substantial opposition.
The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America, is available now from HarperCollins. For the Commonweal Podcast, this is Dominic Preziosi. The Commonweal Podcast is produced by Associate Editor Griffin Olenek and the Commonweal staff, in partnership with Sandberg Media. Wally Boudway composed the music, and David Dalt did the editing. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. And please share it with friends, family, and anyone else who enjoys thoughtful, in-depth conversations like the ones we have here. I'm Dominic Preziosi for the Commonweal Podcast.